Talk given Sunday, 8th October, 1972.
As we have some new friends present here today, it would be well to remind ourselves of what is our purpose in meeting here. What are we concerned with? Our concern essentially is the heart of religion. The context of religion is transcendence itself. So transcendence rarely means the heart of religion. Transcendence is something which cannot be achieved, attained, grasped as one's possession. It is transcendence which takes us into itself when we have ceased to obstruct transcendence. Our concern is with helping ourselves to let the religiousness which lies within our being to come to fruition. Why do I stress religiousness? Because man fundamentally is a religious being first and foremost, and only very secondarily is he a political, economic, social animal. Note carefully the contrast between the two, the religious being and the political, economic, social animal. The terms are used quite correctly. For the animal in us is concerned with the preservation of the self and of the species. And all the activities concerned with that constitute our worldly life in the restricted sense of the word. Our task as human beings is to transform this worldly life into the religious life, in order that transcendence may freely flow in and out through us and bring to fruition its undreamed of, its unimaginable purposes. And you see the difficulty. The animal, which is the organism, is descended from a primordial ancestor who lived according to the law of the jungle. Now, I'm not using the word jungle in any derogatory sense, but the law of the jungle is directed towards the well-being of the separate individual, to the well-being of the species to which that individual belongs. Because of our descent organically from the animal, we have that element strongest in us until we wake up and begin to release the true humanness in us. When we are concerned with releasing the true humanness in us, especially in connection with the bringing to fruition of mind and all that that word stands for, then the law of the spirit applies, which does something other than what the law of the jungle does for us. Because with the law of the spirit, individuality no longer means the separate organism and its well-being and wholeness. But the flowering out in consciousness, in the deeps of mind, into the realization of the totality, which is the one and only true individual, the true I am for each and every one of us as human beings. This transformation of consciousness from the self-centered worldly consciousness into the unself-conscious awareness of totality is the fulfillment of man. Then man truly fulfills the meaning of that very word man, derived from the Sanskrit man, meaning to be creative with mind. We use the word mind, but we don't know precisely what we are talking of when we use the word mind. We haven't begun to know mind and to let mind function freely. What we call mind and mental processes and so forth is almost entirely restricted to ordinary discursive silent talking to ourselves, and that is what we mean by our thinking. We are just talking. Now all this undergoes change. And we naturally ask, well, what is it that obstructs us? Well, let us consider, what is it that obstructs us? We say that appearances are deceptive. We are so conditioned from childhood onwards that we separate out reality or truth or the transcendent from this, which is the external appearance, perhaps the expression of something higher and deeper. We separate out the two. And we take for granted that this separation is the fact. Now, if appearances are deceptive and they are unrelated to reality, then appearance contradicts reality, reality contradicts appearance. And if that is the case, from the beginning to the end, so to say, of things, there are two unrelated absolutes. The mortal, ever-changing, ever-deceiving appearance on the one hand, and the immortal, transcendent reality on the other hand. Now, you can't have two absolutes, because you completely deny the meaning of the word absolute in that case. We have to understand this in a somewhat different way. I, as I am, the imperfect one, the ignorant one, the confused one, the limited one, function in a certain way. A limited way. Because of my conditioning and my limitations, I never really see the appearance as the fact. I see the mental picture that is formed in my mind by the appearance. If we as human beings, experiencing an appearance, really experienced the truth of it, then we would all know that truth the fact about it. But if we take 1 million different people and present them with one small event and ask them to describe it, there will be 1 million different descriptions. Not the identical description, but the event was the one identical event, the one simple truth of the matter. This means, therefore, that what we are seeing is not a direct perception of that which is seen, but an interpretation by me of the impression made upon my mind by what is happening. And since every one of us is different, and all our minds are different, therefore the description by the 1 million people of the one single event will be 1 million different descriptions. Now look at the other aspect, reality. We human beings have a naive, somewhat pathetic way of saying, oh, we are realists. We want the facts. We are hard-headed, objective people. Throughout the ages, we humans have talked that nonsense without ever waking up to the fact of our folly. We define reality. We don't directly experience it or perceive it. When we use the word reality, we have a concept in our mind about reality. And into that concept, we want to fit in the universal process. And we come up against it all the time and experience this suffering, the misery, the difficulties and so on that we do experience. We know nothing about reality, but we will obstinately cling to our definition of reality, our concept. Now, who is the concept maker? Myself. And who am I? The person who knows truth, who is capable of seeing reality? Not a bit of it. I am just what I am, a fallible human, full of errors, full of misperceptions, suffering from incapacity in so many ways. And I blithely define reality and say that that is reality. It's nothing to do with it. So you see, both ways, whether it's a case of the appearance or whether it's a case of reality, I am the one who is in this disharmonious, muddled state. So now, if we look at this statement, appearances are deceptive. Perhaps, would it not be wiser to regard it this way? Let me cease saying that appearances are deceptive. Let me pay attention to the fact that I haven't got the ability, the capacity, to interpret the appearance correctly, to understand the appearance correctly, or in other words, to have direct and complete perception, unerring insight into the appearance and the wholeness of it. You can take a simple example. We human beings, all through our lives, are in contact with each other. Say, we have business dealings with so and so. We have an impression of what that person's character is like, his ability is like. One day we discover that, oh, he deceived us, or some such thing. That is what we say, that he deceived us. But you see, we are giving away the fact that right from the beginning we were unable to see into the whole of him. We saw an appearance, John Brown. And we came to certain conclusions that that is John Brown. And we were wrong. We don't know John Brown. So you see, really, it's not the appearance that is deceptive. It is I who am not capable of seeing the whole truth. Why am I not capable of seeing the whole truth? Is it not because I am subject to this everlasting conflict brought about by duality, the fundamental duality of self and not self? I use the word universe, which will mean a one total reality. It's a universe, not a multiverse. That, although I use the word universe, I don't live in accordance with the real meaning of the word universe, which I do happen to know verbally. That it is a one thing. I am conscious of myself as separate from the universe. It is always a case of you and I. This situation and I. This is the fundamental duality which clouds my consciousness, which keeps me bound in the state of ignorance. Not an intellectual ignorance. Talking with somebody, we can quite agree, oh yes, of course, what we are saying is perfectly true, that this is the fundamental duality. Having said it is so, we have done nothing to remove it. It is like agreeing, oh yes, there is some mud which that passing motor car threw up, and it's on the tip of my nose, but I do nothing to clean it off. I'm not capable of doing it. Now, of course, in the physical case, I am capable. But where consciousness is concerned, the mode in which I am aware of existence, I am quite incapable. So, stemming from that fundamental duality right down in my consciousness, and remaining bound by it, I make statements like appearances are deceptive, and I separate appearance from reality, the body from the spirit, or the body from the mind, and so on. I separate all along the line. I sunder the unity of the universe in all my functioning, all of it. Now, the task of the religia, the one who is seriously concerned with the heart of religion, is to see this within himself. To see all that rises up in him, which perpetuates this sundering, this cutting tendency to split things apart. We must see all that in ourselves, and seeing it clearly, become free of it. The psyche becomes free by the act of seeing. In the case of the psyche, diagnosis and cure are identical. They are not two separate things. With the physical body, if a doctor says, oh, you've got cirrhosis of the liver or something, then he'll give you a pill or ask you to throw away all your whiskey bottles and so forth, you see. A doctor will do that, and you will do it. And they are two separate things, the diagnosis and the cure. They are related in the fact that because one diagnosed correctly, and because one happens to know what is the remedy for it, one gives the remedy or carries it out physically. But where the mind is concerned, the act of seeing the fact of the mind is that which transforms the mind and purifies it. This we must bear in mind very carefully. Now, the religia, therefore, is concerned with ceasing to be an obtrusion upon the universe, upon the world. If we look at our life very carefully, not just the external actions as such, but the inward state of consciousness, the desires and the planning and the drives and so forth, we will see that all these are self-centered. And they remain self-centered, just as with the animal, simply because we haven't wakened up to the true meaning of of the significance of being a man. Now, the whole task of release, the discipline, if one may say so, of release, is to be watchful, to be awake. Remember Jesus' words, watch and pray. And to pray means to be in communion, not just go through a verbal ritual, which is mumbled off, or even spoken, sung with utter sincerity and fullness of heart, but which still proves ineffective. To pray means to be in real communion. And we know real communion in our own lives when there is real love between oneself and the so-called other person. And in that state, there is no consciousness of you and I. It is an awareness of us, the unity. Pray in that sense. And the Buddha said, Samasati, perfect mindfulness, and Samasamadhi, perfect communion, free your minds from this rather inadequate translation into English of the word Samadhi as concentration. It is not concentration in that exclusive sense. It is awareness in the totally inclusive sense. This is this samadhi. If you look deeply into your Patanjali, for instance, you will find it clearly shown what is the meaning of this samadhi, what is called the asampranyata samadhi. There are the two types. The sampranyata, having an object of attention, and that object is usually presented as Brahman, ultimately. And the asampranyata, without an object of attention. The point being that right up to the attention with an object, there is the separation, the object and I. And always, that object remains a postulated object, something which my mind manufactures, my incomplete, imperfect mind manufactures, and presents as a picture outside myself. But with the real asampraññāta samādhi, all that has vanished. The union is real, it's total. And in that real, total union, there is no obtrusive, no isolative self-consciousness. This is the very important thing to bear in mind. And this is the fundamental, the profoundest, the ultimate purpose of yoga. Now I mention this so strongly because all the world over, not merely here or in Africa or India or anywhere, but all the world over, the great mistake made by the religious, by the would-be yogi, is to pursue yoga in order to attain a result. This precisely defeats yoga. It leaves me at the separative animal consciousness level. Instead of completely transcending this isolated self-consciousness. And because one pursues it with the object of gaining something, one goes through set disciplines, particularly, of course, the usual disciplines of bodily posture and breathing. Now, posture and breathing are the least important part of the whole thing. They are techniques. And any technique whatsoever, whether in this field or in any field in the world of worldly things too, any technique whatsoever is directed towards obtaining a result. And if you look deeply into your minds and hearts, you will find, if you can look that deep into the depths, that that result is for oneself. We may say, oh no, I am concerned for the good of humanity, for the community, for society, to help human beings and all the rest of it. Be very careful of these words. The mind raises up all these wonderful pictures, cobwebs, intellectual cobwebs, partly in order to excuse oneself for one's selfishness. This must be carefully borne in mind. And partly because it is incapable, sadly incapable, of seeing otherwise. No technique, because every technique deals with power. Let me use the word power instead of technique. Any power is invariably, I say without exception, invariably and inevitably misused in some way or other until there is the harmony of love and wisdom in perfection, in transcendence. Now you will see that the real teachings of yoga emphasize the purification part first and foremost. Then, if you like, associate physical disciplinary techniques with it. But the purification part, which is concerned with release from all our unvirtuousness is the fundamental, indispensable basis. If this is not attended to, if this is not allowed to come to some considerable degree of fruition, then any technique which we utilize in terms of posture and breathing will certainly bring us what seem to be certain advantages in health and this, that and the other. But beware, they stir up the psyche. And they stir up the depths of the psyche which are hidden from one's gaze. And in due time, in the ripeness of circumstance, they bring destruction to the person and to his environment when they work out. Don't send in an application to God to come to you unless you are utterly pure. And if you are utterly pure, you don't need to apply or desire. God is there. No longer hidden, but open. Now, what is the particular purpose of the discipline of the postures, for instance? To cease, the purpose is that the body shall no longer be an obstruction to the profoundest aspect of yoga, which is meditation. Meditation not in the childish sense of just musing in your mind. Anybody and everybody muses. Anybody and everybody spends hours thinking about this, that or the other. Not meditation in that sense. Not an intellectual churning up of the mind. It means the state of conscious communion, where the differentiation between thou and I, the world and I, has really vanished. And one's whole mind and heart is an open vessel, empty, transparent, unresisting to the inflow and outflow of transcendent energy, which is the energy of pure mind. That is the most important thing, that meditation part, which, to use the Sanskrit words, is named pratyahara, usually translated somewhat inadequately, as the withdrawing of the senses from the objects of sense. It's not a withdrawing of the senses from the objects of the sense, but letting one's whole mind be free of attachment and aversion when the senses perform their right function in conveying the objects of sense to your own awareness. That is the pratyahara. To remain free of attachment and of aversion. And then comes the dharana, the dhyana, and the samadhi. Dharana, derived from the root dhri, meaning to uphold. What is it that we uphold? The fundamental, eternal order of universal being. In the Rig Veda, it was called Ripta, from which our English word right, R-I-T-E, any right, is derived. And a right is a ritual process, a ceremonial process, which not merely represents, and it, in the olden days it did not merely represent symbolically, but actually embodied the play and flow of the energies which brought the universe into being. Ritta. That is what one upholds, the eternal order of things. And the upholding of the eternal order of things is appearance, is existence as we know it, and contact it and sense it. We don't sense it and contact it purely and perfectly. We do it in a muddled way. That's another thing. The word existence, existere, means to stand out of. It is a standing out of that fundamental absolute, the unknown eternal reality, whatever it is. The unknown and the unknowable by discursive mind and sense perception. We must bear these things very carefully in mind. You see? So, dharana is the upholding of that ritual process of the universe. You find this extraordinary statement in the Upanishads, that such and such a sage and such a sage were together. Mind you, sage not in our modern limited sense of a very clever fellow, but perfected holy ones. They were considering together the sacrifice. And of course, the dear scholars immediately say, oh yes, of course, in those days they had animal sacrifices, this sacrifice, that sacrifice. They were not concerned with the mumbo jumbo of the whole thing. They were concerned with this activity of transcendent energies which made sacred that which was going on. To sacrifice means to make sacred. And we must remember this. So that was the dharana. And the dhyana is the paying attention. Now, let us be very clear about this. We know the meaning of paying attention in the ordinary way. I, the separate person, am paying attention to you, another person, to a process, to a phenomenon. That, of course, is the starting point for us as we are here in the ordinary physical waking state. But this dhyana, this paying attention in dhyana is something quite different. The sense functions are all pacified and at rest. The discursive mind has stopped chattering. Now, in that state of complete poise, a dynamic poise, completely alert, utterly at peace, in perfect equanimity, in that state, with the mind quiet, the innermost reality and depth of consciousness is at one, made one with all that is. There is no particular object of attention at all. This is the meaning of dhyana. This is the entry into the real states of meditation. And in the chakra symbolism of yoga, it is represented by the Vishuddhi, the Ajna, and the Sahasrara chakras. The Sahasrara symbolically is the point of union, the point of contact of the transcendent eternal reality with this here and now, the mortal, which is changing, which comes to birth, grows, decays, and dies. And all the other chakras below the anahata level deal with the mortal purely and simply. What we call thinking, our discursive chatter, is born of the activity of the so-called lower chakras, Muladhara, Swadhisthana, and Manipura, which deal with food and sex, in other words, with self-preservation and the preservation of the species, and also with the ordinary commerce of everyday life. buying, selling, working, enjoying social exchanges, cultural activities and entertainments, and in short, the whole of our ordinary worldly life. Note carefully that in this state, all our discursive thought and speech is confined to the dualistic worldly sphere, with its conflicts and sorrows, its perplexities and failures, its ephemeral joys and its temporal bubbles of success. Rarely is there a gleam of the beauty of truth, or a sudden vision of the splendor and marvel of the reality awaiting discovery. Now, if there has been true discipline, that is, real learning, the sense functioning calm, pacified and not repressed, then the mind becomes unified, poised, awake and open, and hence very alert and sensitive. It becomes silent, and yet includes all sound. A paradox, if you like. All chitta-vritti, the chaotic flitting of attention, has ceased. In this silence, there is no discursive worldly chatter. Instead of the discordance of conflicting duals, there is the harmony of life in its wholeness, of the holy state. In this state, thought in its profound real nature, as a creative and transformative power, wordless and formless, emerges and functions. And its functioning can release speech and forms which express transcendence uninterfered with, unbesmirched by worldliness. In the symbolic terms of yoga, the Vishuddhi or throat chakra comes into its own. The throat chakra, as you know, deals with speech. And speech, no longer false, rude, slanderous, or malicious, no longer scheming evil, no longer harmful, is now that pure and true speech, which is prophetic speech. That is, speech which inspires the sensitive listener to awaken to truth, to glimpse the reality and beauty of transcendence. It is speech which comforts and heals. Further, the Ajna chakra, the center between the eyebrows, which is said to be concerned with knowledge. But knowledge here must be understood as pure wisdom and vision. This chakra is activated and gives rise to thought, or rather, I should say, to the free play of mind energy, which is in rhythm with and upholds the eternal order of universal process, the divine sacrificial activity, or Rishta. Thus we see here Pratyahara, Dharana, and Dhyana in some of their deeper meanings. And now maybe we can sense, at least in small measure, whither it is that yoga leads us. It leads us, amongst other things, to this transformation of speech and thought, which expresses the inflowing and the outflowing of pure mind, transcendent energy, through your own living organism. And then, whatever is seen by you, the appearance, is identical with reality. For when you are pure, free of all self-seeking, you cast no shadow upon the infinite reality, for you are the enlightened one. Lighted up from within, no shadow can be cast upon that which is without. You are the divinized son of man, the myth of the man-god come true. You are free of all duality and the confusions and the conflicts consequent upon duality. Unified, made whole, transcendence realizes itself through you.